Okay, as people come in, I want to get started on the next half of this session. The next talk is going to be by Mike Barlow, who is filling in for Haley Gomez, who couldn't make it. Oh, we've got... Okay, good. Mike will be telling us about supernova dust factories. Are we good? Yeah. So this is a half-hour talk, and I'll give you a warning.
All right, well, thank you, and good morning. Haley was due to give this talk, but one of her children was taken ill, and so she's been unable to travel. However, she had prepared most of the talk, so what you've seen, 90% of the slides were actually produced by Haley. So, let's go. Supernovae have been proposed as sources of dust for quite a long time, but had sort of been ignored for a long time as well. And it was the advent of submillimeter astronomy in the late 90s that produced many detections of high redshift galaxies with large quantities of dust in them. And for instance, galaxies at redshift greater than 4 found to be very dusty, and galaxies at redshift 6.4 to 8.6 have been found. For instance, the record holder 8.6, Laporte et al., has 10 to the 8 solar masses of dust in it. And it's emitting just over 300 million years after the Big Bang. So this doesn't give very much time for the classical sources of dust like AGB stars and M supergiant. So supernovae were immediately then thought to be the real candidates. Models for the dust, this is a sample of galaxies with redshifts greater than 1. Low and intermediate mass stars, that's AGB stars mainly, were unable to fit the required amounts of dust that are present in these galaxies. Each of these is a separate galaxy. However, once supernovae, where the particular yield were put in, and that yield was between 0.1 and 1 solar mass of dust per supernova, then you can begin to match the required amounts of dust that are in these galaxies. So the question is, can supernovae do this? Well, first of all, let's look at the formation theory. There's been two types of theory applied, chemical kinetic theory, these authors here, and classical nucleation theory. And this is an example of one of them, Nozawa et al. 2010, for a core collapse supernova producing different types of dust within enclosed mass range. So these studies have then produced a range of predicted dust masses per supernova. This gray area is the sweet spot, 0.1 to 1 solar mass. And you can see quite a lot of the models were predicting the right amount of dust, although not all. And for instance, there are some well below that. Sarangi and Cherchnev and Biscaro and Cherchnev were producing quite a bit less than 0.1 solar mass. So the question is, what are the observations saying? How much dust are they producing? Well, there are a number of ways of diagnosing and measuring the amounts of dust in core collapse supernovae. One is the infrared, the mid-infrared SED. When you get freshly condensed dust at a temperature of about 400 K within a few hundred days, it produces an excess at out to about 10 microns and beyond. And you can see here a snapshot of 2004 ET, 300 days, 360, 406, and 690. And the excess gets larger and larger as the main emission fades in the optical, and the dust is re-emitting here, and the contrast gets greater. This one was found to have silicate peak at 10 microns is the best fit. A second way is if you look at the light curve, the optical light curve, you can sometimes see a dip in the light curve, a deviation from the cobalt 56 expected drop, and that can be attributed again to dust extinction in the ejector and removing light. Third method is a red-blue asymmetry in optical line profiles. I'll come back to that later. Basically, emission from the far side of the ejector has to pass through the middle of the ejector, so the red emission can undergo more extinction than the blue emission on the near side. And going back to far infrared emission, this was the advent of Herschel. It supplements the mid-infrared data that Spitzer, for instance, got. it is sensitive to cold dust emission, whereas Spitzer was sensitive to warm dust emission. When dust is warm, it emits efficiently. You don't need very much dust to produce quite a lot of emission in the mid-infrared region. When you get to the far infrared and submillimeter, dust is cold, and it's very inefficient at emitting, and you need a lot more dust to produce a given flux. So those are a bunch of authors who have all contributed, and there are many papers, particularly out of the Spitzer era. Now, moving into the Herschel and Alma and beyond, just mentioning that the studies of CAS A were done by Dunedau in 2003 and 2009 was at 850 microns with SCUBA on JCMT, where they found excess polarization at 850 microns and 450 microns, which they attributed to one solar mass of dust emitting at about 20 K. Now, with Spitzer, as well as photometry, it could get spectra out to 40 microns. And this shows a montage of Spitzer spectra of CAS A, four different regions. Different colors are referring to different regions of CAS A. And one particular set of regions produces a very strong 21 micron emission feature, which is not at the usual position for silicates, which is usually at 18 microns. 21 microns was attributed to silicates, which are very oxygen-enriched. And that's consistent with CAS A, which is a very oxygen-rich object. From Spitzer, which was only sensitive to the warmer dust, they, Rho et al. Deduced between 0.02 and 0.05 solar masses of dust, emitting at about 50 degrees K. So moving on to Herschel observations of CAS A, this is a montage of red emission at 160 microns, blue at 70 microns. So the red is sensitive to cold dust, and you can see lots of interstellar dust emission. And of course, the extinction towards CAS A is very high, and there's a lot of interstellar dust clouds. Here, the warm supernova dust emitting in the blast wave region, and the cool supernova dust is in the center particularly, and they're mixing together at the blast wave region, the reverse shock region itself. So an analysis, a single SED analysis of the entire SED, deduced 0.1 solar masses of dust at 35 K. Now, this has since been refined by doing a spatially resolved analysis by Deloza et al. 2017, who deduced from this pixel by pixel analysis 0.3 to 0.6 solar masses of ejected dust, emitting at 30 K mainly. There are also components at 80 and 100 K, which are corresponding to these warmer components on the outer side. They produced a dust mass map. Here is the inner, these dotted circles show the outer and inner parts of the reverse shock. And you can see that most of the coal dust is inside the reverse shock, not yet been subjected to going through it and perhaps being destroyed by it. Here's a breakdown of the various components. And you can see the yellow component is the interstellar dust component, which is very, very strong for CAS A. Synchrotron is green, and supernova dust is blue. And emission lines make a small contribution at several wavelengths. So total dust mass, as I said, was 0.3 to 0.5, depending on the type of silicate that you adopt. This is a map of the foreground and background ISM dust that's deduced from fitting the ISM emission. It ranges up to 15 magnitudes at Vmags. And supernova dust itself goes up to one magnitude of extinction inside the remnant. Now, the 15 magnitudes of interstellar dust, if you look at the Green et al. Dust reddening map, you'll find that if you adopt a distance of 3.4 kiloparsecs, about half of the interstellar reddening is in front of CAS A, and about half of this reddening is behind it. So moving on to Crab Nebula, this is a composite image. Blue is the Hubble image of the Crab Nebula, and the red is the Herschel dust image at 70 microns. And this shows a fit by Gomez et al. 2012 to the SED. Now, you can see here that the contrast of the dust emission is much less than in CAS A, because the synchrotron emission in Crab Nebula is extremely strong. The you're less affected by interstellar dust emission because it's in the anti-center direction of the galaxy. So the interstellar dust emission is quite small, but to just make it more difficult, the synchrotron emission is very strong. And fitting that is a very important part of the whole exercise. So Gomez et al. Got between 0.1 to 0.2 solar masses of dust. An alternative analysis by Taemin and Dweck, 2013, got down to 0.02 solar masses and up to 0.13 by doing a multi-component dust fit. That is, different grain sizes produce these different spectra of fits, which you added together give a fit to the whole SED with less, potentially less dust mass. A radiative transfer model, where you use the synchrotron to heat the dust grains, produced a larger dust estimate between 0.18 and 0.5 solar masses. So this has recently been reanalyzed by Deloze et al., 2019, again with a spatially resolved analysis, just like in CAS-A. And a lot of effort went into fitting the synchrotron emission. Synchrotron is constrained at this end by the radio emission, and at this end by Spitzer, where the IRAC observations between 3.6 and 8 microns are actually sampling the synchrotron emission. In between, you have the dust emission. And making it difficult is this bump at millimeter wavelengths, which is rather similar to the anomalous microwave emission that you find in many sources in the galaxy. So synchrotron parlor, warm and cold dust, plus fitting the excess emission, 11 free parameters, came up with a dust mass of, it's in the next poster, it's between 0.03 and 0.05 solar masses. So here you see the synchrotron emission is much larger than in CAS-A. Conversely, the interstellar dust emission is much smaller. And here, the blue, again, is the supernova dust emission. The fits basically found that the peak of the dust emission moved to slightly shorter wavelengths. That means warmer dust. Warmer dust emits more efficiently. You need less dust mass. So the dust mass came down to 0.032 to 0.049. So that was a trip. Lower Spire 500 micron flux helped move the dust peak to shorter wavelengths, as did the better synchrotron fit. So here's a map of the dust mass in the Crab Nebula, and also the map of the reddening, AV. And it gets up to about 0.4 magnitudes at this largest point. So together, that AV between 0.2 and 0.38 is consistent with the optical globule analysis of Grenman et al., 2017, who analyzed the extinction individual globules in the optical and got similar extinctions, up to a half a magnitude or so. The implied dust condensation efficiency, if you assume it came from a 9 to 11 solar mass progenitor, is between 8 and 12% of the heavy elements have gone into dust. The excess here has got some implications. It could be secondary synchrotron component. It could be free emission from very hot plasma. More interestingly, it might be spinning dust grains, as have been suggested for the anomalous microwave emission. Or it might be magnetic iron-bearing grains, which can also produce a bump at that wavelength. The excess peaks around 2 millimeters, between 140 and 150 gigahertz. So moving to another source which has recently been analyzed, G54.1 plus 0.3. It's a twin of CAS-A in its infrared spectrum. It has a 21 micron emission feature, which again can be attributed to very oxygen-rich silicated dust grains. So it's been analyzed by Taemin et al. 2017, who deduced 1.1 solar masses of dust. Had to take into account the fact that there's a nearby OB cluster, which is producing some of the heating for this emission, as well as the synchrotron heating for the dust emission. And also, it's been analyzed by Roh et al. 2018, who got a dust mass of between 0.1 and 0.9 solar masses. So again, attributed to grains of silica. So moving on to supernova 1987A now, the archetype, really, of dust formation, the one that was best studied, and we're getting most of our best information from. These are spectra taken with the Kuiper Airborne Observatory back in the late 70s, early 80s. Day 415, day 615, day 775, and this is a fit to the day 775 spectrum. So you can see after about day 400, beginning to develop an excess, which became more and more pronounced as time went on. And it's consistent with the idea that when the ejecta is moving out and cooling, when it reaches a temperature of about 400K, then dust formation proceeds efficiently. There's also, of course, a well-known equatorial ring around the source. This is an optical HST image, and you can see a ghostly image in the center of the ejecta. It's rather like a peanut with a hole in the middle. And Boucher et al. 2006, and in subsequent observations, found that the ring is emitting very strongly in dust, silicate dust, and the mass of silicate dust is 10 to the minus 6 solar masses. And that's from the progenitor ejection before the supernova took place. Of course, there's much, much more dust in the ejecta itself. And that was picked up, first of all, by Herschel as part of the Maxner's et al.'s survey of the Magellanic Clouds. A point source was found coincident in position with 87A, at 250 microns and at shorter wavelengths. This was then zooming in from here for the Herschel to the Spitzer image at 24 microns to HST, H-alpha. There's the ejector, the ghostly ejector image. And here is the ALMA 450 micron image following up the Herschel observations. And it's exactly coincident with the ejector in the center. There was doubt, of course. Herschel's angular resolution was quite low, so there were alternative suggestions that it might be a background source. But ALMA pinned it down. It was definitely in the ejector. And the amount of dust that was deduced was about 0.5 solar masses of dust. And that was at day 9,200. Here is an ALMA cycle 2 image. 450 in white or reddish, 870 in blue, and purple is H-alpha from HST. This is a recently produced paper by Sagan et al., which is in preparation. And again, at 450, you can see the ejecta dust. So here is the Sagan et al. Fit, the latest fit, you might say, because it's been done multiple times. 0.2 to 0.4 solar masses of dust, consisting of silicates and amorphous carbon. Here's a sequence of images. This is the non-thermal emission, synchrotron emission, in the equatorial ring, also at 315, but you're beginning to fill it in with dust emission. And 679 gigahertz, you're on the tail, the Roentgen's tail of the dust emission, which is basically filling in the hole in the H-alpha, the keyhole, as it's been called. This is the key that's filling in the keyhole. So dust in the ejector is asymmetric. It's very clumpy, and it has features resolved down to the resolution limit of ALMA, which is 63 by 81 milliarc seconds in these images. Right. Now, Mikako is going to, in the next talk, is going to give a review of 87A, so I'm not going to spend very much time on this. CO was detected by Kamenetsky et al. 2013, and it was again in the center of the ring. It was in the ejecta. And cycle two, when they had many more dishes and bigger baselines, have filled in much more detail. The CO and SIO are both present, and the SIO is in green, CO is in red. And you can see they have different distributions. And I won't spend much time in here. Mikako will probably update us, but there's a sequence now of SIO and CO molecular band images in different rotational lines of those species. Right, and also a later talk in this session this morning by Hannah Chorner, who analyzed what we call a complete Herschel survey of Milky Way supernova remnants using Higgall data from Herschel. Higgall was between plus and minus 1 degree of the galactic plane. It picked up 190 supernova remnants were within its coverage. Out of about 295 in the green, the latest green catalog. So it's a very high fraction of the total number in the galaxy are in that plus or minus one declination limit. So Right, and I'll just concentrate on three. One of the things that was notable about the CHOANA survey is it was picking up particularly pulsar wind nebulae. It was harder to see dust in the standard supernova remnants, the old supernova remnants. And the main reason for that is when they get old, they're heated by the interstellar dust radiation field. The dust is at the same temperature as the interstellar dust. Therefore, it's very hard to see them in contrast against the background and foreground interstellar dust emission. But if they've got a pulsar wind nebula or some other internal source of heating, it raises the temperature of the dust, shifts it to shorter wavelengths, and makes it easier to pick up the supernova dust emission. So pulsar wind nebulae are particularly favored, therefore. And a detailed, spatially resolved analysis of these three objects give dust masses 0.3, 0.3, 0.5 solar masses. Now, G29.7 is also known as KES-75, and it's a recent paper by Taemin et al. In an archive, where the dust mass is found to be between 0.04 and 0.15 solar masses. So those are they're differing by a factor of four or so in their dust mass estimate. But you may hear more about that in Hannah's talk. Now, this is a well-known diagram that Chris de Gaulle et al. Produced in 2014 in Nature, where they put together a disparate group of supernovae for which dust masses had been estimated and found a trend that if you start at very early days, you get very small dust masses, and they're increasing up to 87A, which was 25 years after outburst. And the dust masses are reaching up to half a solar mass and beyond at that stage. Now, an analysis by Wesson et al. In 2015, just of supernova 87A, produced this blue line. So it was an analysis of the dust SEDs. These SEDs here, day 615, 775, 1153, 8515. This is the Herschel epoch. So the dust is basically getting weaker. It's cooling and moving to longer wavelengths. But there are constraints at 100 microns. The upper limits are at 50 from the KAO in those epochs. So those are very useful to put upper limits to the dust temperature. So going back, then the trend that find the blue line for 87A alone is consistent with the Gaulle et al. Sequence for all these other objects. The dust mass appears to grow in 87A from 0.002 to 0.6 solar masses in 25 years, which that is in contradiction to what dust mass condensation models predict, which say that it should all happen within about 1,000 days. Now, you have another way of getting dust masses I alluded to at the beginning, which is by the red-blue profile asymmetries. So the emission from the far side undergoes more dust extinction than the emission on the near side. And you see this, the yellow here is what a symmetric line profile would look like around zero. And for this is SN2005IP in H-alpha, and this is H-beta, day 4075. So we're 12 or 13 years after outburst. You need 0.1 solar mass to fit the H-alpha as you do in the H-beta. And the red line is the model fit to the observed profile. Similarly, you can do a model fit to 2010 JL, day 915 and day 1296, and you get 8 by 10 to the minus 4 solar masses at day 915, going up to 2.1 by 10 to the minus 3 solar masses at day 1286. And there are fits to later epochs, as well as I'll show in a second. So this is one of these interacting shock supernovae. You have a circumstellar medium outside, gets shocked. You have shocked CSM, shocked ejector, cool dense shell, you name it, they're all there. And this is the unshocked ejector with the ejector dust inside it. And most of the dust is found to be in the ejector, just like a normal supernova like 87A, which doesn't have this shock scenario around it. Right, so this is a composite of fits from red-blue asymmetries called Damocles. This is the optical line profiles, and optical infrared SEDs with Moccasin, which is the 3D radiative transfer code. So 1980K, 87A, 93J, 95N, 2005IP, 2010 JL. All of these methods. So they start down at just above 10 to the minus 8 a few days after outburst, and moving up a sequence which takes you up to between 0.1 and 1 solar mass at day 10,000 and beyond. So this is consistent with the amounts of dust mass that you're requiring to fit high redshift of galaxies. So the question is, why is it taking so long to show up? Models are predicting it should be up to this value after 1,000 days. So the inferred growth of ejected dust mass is well beyond 1,500 days, seriously disagrees with the dust condensation models, which predict an end by the dust mass growth by then. Now, Dweck and Arendt 2015 and Dweck, Sarangi and Arendt 2019 have argued that this dichotomy can be resolved if the ejected dust masses actually did grow to their final values before day 1,000, but were hidden effectively in highly optically thick regions that are only unveiled later as the ejector expands, the optical depth decreases, and the IR SED then begins to pick up more and more dust from the continued expansion. So in contravention of this, Wesson et al.'s numerical modeling of the optical IR SED of 87A at multiple epochs found a dust mass of 0.003 on day 1153, where you had 100 micron upper limit, with dust masses significantly larger than this at this epoch firmly ruled out, according to their paper. And also from optical line profile modeling, Bevan and Ball ruled out 87A dust masses larger than 0.003 on day 714, and for silicates, the upper limit was 0.07. So this is a major disagreement. The issue is currently unresolved. Now, just say we do get our half a solar mass of dust. The other problem is that the reverse shock can destroy it. And observational analyses by these authors here of different supernova remnants, they found evidence that the dust was being destroyed, the small amounts of dust in the regions that had already been processed by the reverse shock. There have been radiative transfer and hydrodynamic models of dust destruction by Bocchio et al. 2016, Misolotta et al. 2016, a poster by John Slavin, poster 510, and a poster by Florian Kirschlager et al., poster 5.5, which look at dust destruction. So I'll leave you to look at those. CASA shows that evidence of dust, of CO reforming behind the reverse shock. There's broad CO emission inside the ejector, and it's coming from inside the reverse shock. It's a downstream region where it's already been shocked. So in principle, if you can form CO in the downstream region, you might actually be able to reform dust as well. And studies of 2010 JL and also of the Crab Nebula and other remnants, I find evidence that you'll have large dust grains. Now, the larger the dust grain size, the better it can withstand sputtering, because the sputtering rate is constant, dA by dt. So you divide that into the grain radius. The bigger the grain, the longer it lasts. But grain-grain collisions can break up grains and can produce smaller grains, which then make it easier for sputtering to destroy them. Just finish off by briefly talking about type 1As. The bottom line is we find no evidence for any dust formation in type 1A supernova remnants. This is a model by Nozawa et al. 2011, where they have formation of 0.2 of a solar mass of dust in a type 1A. And then as you interact with the interstellar medium, the reverse shock moves back inwards and begins to destroy the dust. So if you have a high density in the interstellar medium, like 1, you'll destroy the dust faster than if you have a lower density of 0.3. So this is the current age of Tycho and Kepler, which are both type 1As. So how much dust is in them? Well, there's the Tycho. This is a 70 micron image with Herschel with 160, the red background. Kepler, the same. And these are two type 1As from the Chorner et al. Survey. And basically, if you look at Kepler, all the dust emission is at the edge. It's consistent with swept up circumstellar medium dust, which is being destroyed, perhaps. But the total mass is only 10 to the minus 3 solar masses, and there's no dust within it. This is the X-ray image with the 70 micron contours exactly corresponding to the blast wave interacting with the circumstellar medium. This is Tycho. Tycho, again, is ghostly, and there's nothing inside, no dust at all. 100K dust is seen at the edge. It's consistent with swept up interstellar medium dust, less than hundreds of a solar mass of dust. And this is a comparison of hard X-ray, optical, and 70 micron. They're all at the edge of the nebula. So no clear evidence for dust in the ejecta of 1As. In this particular case of Tycho, it was swept up interstellar dust. And here is a model. Well, here are the upper limits for Tycho and Kepler placed on the prediction of the Nozawa et al. Model. And you can see they're very much less than the predictions. There have been other models for condensation of dust in type 1As, which say, well, the expansion speeds are so fast in type 1As that the density drops too fast, plus the radiation environment from radioactive isotopes is 10 times higher, because the dust, the nickel-56 mass is 10 times higher than a core collapse. So that's very inimical to forming dust, perhaps, in type 1As. The problem is, where is the iron-bearing dust in the interstellar medium? Because we know in the interstellar medium, the iron is depleted by a factor of 100. It must be in dust. So where is that dust made? We don't know. So here's a summary of where we stand, perhaps. Consensus and conflict issues. Dust and molecules are definitely formed in core collapse. Significantly quantities found in those and in pulsar wind nebulae particularly. Each core collapse supernova produces 0.1 to 1 solar mass as required. Grains appear to be large. Mass grows up to at least 1,500 days, but there's arguments about whether it formed before 1,500 days. How much of this dust survives? That's still an open question. Okay, thank you.
Wow, an incredibly rich review. It's unfortunate that Haley couldn't make it, but Mike, you did an excellent job. Thank you. So we're ready for questions. If we could have the lights up so I could see hands, please. Yes?
Regarding the question of dust formation and survival, that also depends upon the composition and size of the grains, et cetera. So did you have to take that into account? I mean, can you make a comment on...
Well, the models that they do it for both carbon dust grains and silicate dust grains and other species. Yes, carbon dust grains are much more resistant than silicate dust grains.
And as people are thinking about... Oh, there's Evo. Sure. Before I get... As the microphone's going there, just a comment for me. It's fascinating showing these... maps of where the dust emission lies with respect to, say, ejecta. In the Cassay, it seemed quite clumped in one region as opposed to naively thinking it's distributed.
Yeah.
So it's one of the power of these observations. Evo, please.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, I saw a talk by Eli Dweck, and in this talk, I found it very convincing. The argument was that for 87A, at least, pretty much all the dust forms very early on in just a first couple hundred days or so. And then the seemingly increase of the dust mass was explained by essentially optical depth just decreasing. Can you comment on that, please?
Yes. I mean, I alluded to that, and the idea that you can hide a lot of dust. The problem is you've got to... The models that they produced were for the optical IR SED. They need to be confronted with both the optical IR SED limits and also with the red-blue asymmetries, which undergo different aspects, you might say. So the two together need to be satisfied. That's yet to be really put... The confrontation is yet to take place, let's say. If I can just... Can we move on to... I'll do one slide, which was a backup. Yes. Ellie, in 1988, published a paper anticipating the formation of dust in 87A and wondering, will dust black out 87A by getting optically thick? That didn't happen. And that's one of the issues. If you form optically thick dust clumps in 87A or any other remnant, the covering factor has got to be below a certain value, or else you'll just black the whole thing out. So you've got to actually be constrained by that as well.
There's a question. Oh, yep.
You're using this against me. Well, first of all, I assumed here totally spherically symmetric ejecta and so on. So you can obscure it. And anyway, this is kind of like a wrong scenario. But the most misleading figure is the figure of Gao that you showed. Mm-hmm. And the reason it is misleading is that it has a mishmash of all kind of supernova remnant and supernovae. In other words, some of the supernova, it is circumstellar dust. And connecting the points to suggest an evolutionary scenario is really misleading. Second, if you look at the time behavior, it goes as t squared, which is exactly the rate at which a surface expands. So it is very suggestive that it is an optical depth effect. And with regard to the, we kind of like are going to resolve this, right, Mike? With regard to the line asymmetries, these have been used, these have been calculated for spherical symmetric ejecta. And we see that 87A is totally cigar-shaped, clumpy, whatever it is. So it really requires much more detailed kind of analysis of where the dust forms, where the ejecta, where the emitting atomic lines are, and so on.
Well, certainly so, Damocles can treat any geometry that you suggested. Right. One of the things is that you've got a, not just 87A, you've got many supernovae that we can observe. So with regular asymmetries, your viewing angle is going to be different for every remnant. So they won't all be, if they're bipolar, they won't all be same viewing angle. So you'll get different amounts of red-blue asymmetry and so forth. Right.
Yes.
So in 87A, we don't really see any change of the line profiles that we can attribute to dust at late times. So how do you reconcile with that with your model of forming the dust very late?
Yeah, 87A line profiles did evolve. And they showed a red-blue asymmetries from about day 700. And in fact, Lucy et al. 89 analyzed the oxygen 16300 line at day 700 and deduced about 10 to the minus 4 solar masses of dust. That was the original use of that method. But the later analyses, they can go up to about year 9. After year 9, the interaction with the equatorial ring produced so much H-alpha emission that it blotted out the main ejector H-alpha profile. So,
but for example, we've seen the 1.64 micron line. That's not affected by the X-rays. And the profile has stayed remarkably constant since around 6,500 days.
Well, that would be a function of optical depth. Of course, the optical depth is going to be less at 1.64, depending on the grain size.
Very good. And we're just about on time. Let's thank Mike again for the review. Very good.